again from the dead. I'm gonna hide and you won't see me again. You laughed at me, but now you know I think it's my turn. You say you know, but you have goals on the pain.
Hi, and welcome to Halfway to History. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Kylie.
And this is a show where we talk about the upcoming week, but a long time ago.
And sometimes not so long ago.
Yeah. Do we have any updates this week?
I do, actually.
Oh.
I realize I wrote them on the top of my notes and not...
Whoops.
Just don't let me do the update next week, too.
Okay. One update from Kylie.
So the female astronomer who came up with the stellar classification system that we talked about in your last episode,
yep,
was Annie Jump Cannon. And her system is actually still used today with only some minor modifications.
Cool.
Yeah, I realized that we like failed epically at remembering her name last time.
I
was like, we should really rectify that. She deserves to be remembered.
Yes. Also, I have an update.
Oh.
We got our first feedback through the email.
Woohoo!
So it was from my mom. But she was saying that she does like the separate stuff that we're doing now. She was saying it's easier to digest all the information when it's just one topic instead of trying to remember two topics every time.
Yeah.
And that's good feedback.
That definitely makes sense, too, because like it's hard to take in a lot of information all at once. And when you're doing two very different things, it's a lot harder.
It also gives us more time to get our notes together.
Which is never a bad thing.
Yes. I think that's it.
Yep, I'm good.
Let's start my topic. So this is for the week of April 27th to May 3rd. And my topic is on April 27th of 1986, where HBO's broadcast is hacked by Captain Midnight.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So before we get into this hacking, I want to go over a little bit, a very little bit, about history of broadcast television. So in the 1920s, broadcast television was free over local frequencies. Even when providers began charging viewers for cable access, free broadcasts were also still accessible and intended to be accessible, and remained that way all the way up until the start of the 1970s. However, in the 70s, much of the free broadcasts had been replaced with paid subscriptions via cable, and antennas were starting to be, albeit very slowly, phased out. So now we don't have them.
Boo.
So,
yeah. Sad. I want free TV.
That was until a small community of satellite television enthusiasts, mostly engineers, ended up sharing technology and knowledge on how to construct satellite dishes so that most people would have the ability to rig up satellites in their own yards and houses and get around the cable providers. And there were no laws against this, and it started to become pretty prolific.
Sneaky, sneaky.
Yeah.
That is like the definition of like chaotic good.
It's pirating. So that was there until the 1980s when media companies and cable providers began scrambling their programming.
Oh.
So that's kind of like encrypting, like they'd change around what was happening on the frequencies so that you'd need a specific key or something to be able to actually decode what was going on over the waves.
Kind of like passwords on Wi-Fi.
Yeah. Yeah. So they began scrambling their programming, but they didn't want to completely cut out their audience. So they started selling descrambling codes to satellite owners at a monthly subscription rate as well. Not only that, but to even make use of descrambling the codes, you needed to have a descrambling mechanism as well.
Oh my gosh. Good Lord.
Yeah, so both of which cost kind of a pretty penny, and obviously we're trying to push people into cable subscriptions.
Obviously.
Which they were selling at considerably cheaper of a price.
Hmm.
So satellite enthusiasts were pretty upset by this, since they felt that they should get cheaper access, since they were already required to build and maintain their own equipment, and this was something that the providers wouldn't have to worry about maintaining themselves if there were any cable outages or equipment malfunctions. So their argument is, we built our own boxes. Why should we have to pay for this? Whereas if you provided someone a box through a cable subscription, they would have to go out there and maintenance it and make sure that it was running. And so they were saying that their prize, essentially, for doing all the work for the cable companies was they should be able to have free access.
I see where they're coming from.
Yeah. Or at least people probably thought that they should have gotten, like, discounted access.
I get that, because, like, it's like having your own, like, internet box when you get internet from, like, Xfinity or whatever.
Yeah, like, if you already have a box right, of theirs, you don't have to pay for the insulation and all that stuff.
Yeah, and like I think they charge like a monthly fee for using their box or whatever it is. I can't remember because I had my own, so I didn't do it when I paid for our internet. So, I mean, that makes sense, right? Like, they're not maintaining your equipment, therefore, like, shouldn't have to...
But their whole business is the content of which they're getting for free.
That is true, yes.
So no actual money is making it back to the cable providers, which is why it is still piracy.
Yeah, all right.
But there were no laws against this.
True.
One of the final nails in the satellite coffin was when the home box office, or HBO, began scrambling every 24 hours on January 15th of 1986 and offered subscriptions to home dish owners for $30 a month in today's money.
All right.
Pretty expensive subscription service.
Yeah.
And they were scrambling so frequently that the satellite pirators could not keep up with it. Yeah. And then the descrambler that HBO was selling was $940 in today's money.
Woof.
Yeah.
Ouch.
So given the popularity of HBO and the inability to pay such exorbitant prices for most people, this finally convinced many to switch from their home satellites to cable. So because of this, the satellite hobby and related industries kind of crashed almost instantly.
No.
And protests against this move started springing up really quickly and frequently. One such protest was by members of the Satellite Television Industry Association, who converged on Washington, D.C. in March of 1986 to urge that the United States Congress protect access to satellite transmissions.
Hmm.
So just a month later is when we catch back up to my topic for the week.
Okay.
So on April 27th of 1986, someone using the pseudonym Captain Midnight jammed HBO's satellite signal on their Galaxy One satellite during the last few minutes of the credits of a showing of Pee-wee's Playhouse, and during the first few minutes of a showing of The Falcon and the Snowman. The broadcasted message lasted for just 4.5 minutes and was seen by more than half of all HBO subscribers.
Wow.
So a technician at HBO's communication center in Hopog or Hopogee, Long Island, I don't know.
I don't know either.
Fought for control of the transmission by attempting to increase the uplink power from their own equipment, but ended up having to give up at risk of damaging their own satellites because they were just keep having to up the uplink transmission and it was getting dangerous.
Yikes.
Because the person, whoever was on the other end, was also upping the amount of power that they were using to uplink this jamming.
Oh, geez. Okay. So it was like a competition, basically, to keep one step ahead.
Right. So in a short few minutes, the hacker abandoned control of the satellite.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
So it was only 4.5 minutes, but apparently it was worthwhile enough that I found this.
Okay.
So HBO ended up contacting the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, and announced that they would seek prosecution against the hacker. The chairman of HBO, Michael Futches, wrote to the FCC complaining that the company had received calls threatening to place their Galaxy One satellite in a different orbit, but the company was unable to determine whether these were credible threats or not. Futches' letter additionally urged the commission to use all of its resources to capture this culprit. The jamming was even called an act of video terrorism, domestic terrorism, and the like. Richard Smith, chief of the FCC, called an emergency meeting to discuss how the culprit should be caught just a few hours later. The Department of Justice and the FBI were called in to assist in the investigation as well. 100 FCC field offices and monitoring stations across the United States were actively involved in trying to find this hacker.
So my question now is this. What did he transmit?
We'll get there.
Okay, because I'm just like over here like, what warranted this response?
Yeah, to be called a terrorist.
I feel like it's probably not that bad, but like clearly people responded very aggressively to it.
Yes.
Like we're going to get there and you're going to tell me what it is and I'm going to be like, seriously?
Probably.
Okay. All right.
So within just a few days of the investigation being known to the public, more than 200 people called the FBI to confess that they were Captain Midnight. So that probably hampered some things a little bit. To start the case, the FCC obtained copies of the hacking from an FCC engineer and HBO viewers, as tape machines were not running during the jamming, So they needed to collect it from other sources.
Oh, yeah. So all those people who were, like, illegally recording the thing were like, yeah. Here, have mine.
Well, it wasn't illegal back then to record things that were broadcast
that's
either.
That's true. What? Wait a second. Now I'm worried about the legality of all my VHS tapes.
Oh, they're not good.
Okay.
Yep.
Forget I ever said that.
That is piracy. That is why there is an FBI warning at the beginning of all movies.
Shoot.
Kylie's just over here just thinking a lot.
I will not do well in jail. Let's just go with that.
You're fine. So from there, they decided that they probably wouldn't have been able to do this hack without having some pretty sophisticated equipment, and which was similar to what stations used to broadcast in general. So they had a pretty good idea of what someone would have needed to be able to do this. So they determined which teleport uplink sites out of the 2,000 licensed transmitters in the United States had the capability to override the HBO signal. From there, that narrowed it down to 500 uplink sites that had sufficiently large antennas that also had the capability of broadcasting. The FCC removed stations from the list of 500 that were inoperative on April 27th or confirmed to be transmitting other known and scheduled data. This method brought the number of potential stations down to just 12.
Oh, wow.
So after the FCC investigators visited these stations, they were able to narrow the search down to just 3 potential suspects.
Getting closer.
Yeah. So in a very short amount of time, the FCC ended up receiving a tip from someone that was in a rest area off of Interstate 75 in Gainesville, Florida. They reported that they had overheard someone talking about committing the hacking over a payphone at the rest stop. The tip provider obtained and handed over the license plate number of the car that belonged to the person who was using the payphone. The car was owned by John R. McDougall, who was coincidentally one of the 3 remaining suspects in the case.
Uh-oh.
Yep. So McDougall was questioned by the FBI and the FCC and eventually pled guilty in exchange for a year's probation and a $5,000 fine. The alternative was that he could have fought the charge of illegally operating a satellite uplink transmitter in court, but he could have potentially lost $100,000.
Ouch.
In fines. Yeah.
Ouch, that's a lot. That's a huge difference.
Yeah. The FCC agreed to the plea deal because they were less interested in pursuing the prosecution against McDougall, and they were more interested in learning about how he did it. So they accepted it. So what was this terrorist message that caused this wild manhunt and an investigation, as Kylie asked earlier?
Yes, please tell.
The 5-line text message printed in white capital letters that appeared on the screens of approximately 8 million HBO subscribers was, "Good evening, HBO, from Captain Midnight. $12.95 a month? No way. Showtime/movie channels, beware."
And that was it?
That's it.
And that just, like, showed up for, what, like 4.5 minutes?
4.5 minutes.
And that's terrorism.
Terrorism.
I'll call that something else, and it has a two-letter acronym.
What's that?
BS.
Oh, so clever. So yeah, super underwhelming, like just yeah. like you predicted.
That's ridiculous. Guy, that is such an overreaction.
The guy was just annoyed about the subscription fees.
I mean, like, yeah, because yep. like that's like especially back then, like that's an insane amount of money to pay for like.
Yeah, the $12.95 translated to the $30 that I mentioned
right.
earlier, and then
right,
it was
yeah.
almost $1,000 to get a device from HBO to descramble.
Like, I wouldn't pay for that.
Yeah, for one channel.
Right, for one channel. I wouldn't pay for that.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. Like, even now, HBO's like, what, like $15? It's like $14.99, I think.
I have no idea.
I'm the one who pays, and I don't even know.
Yeah. We don't even watch it. I don't even know why you pay it.
Because my dad still watches it. Oh. I told him I was going to get rid of it, and I'm pretty sure he was about to cry. So, and very frequently I will log into my Amazon Prime to like look for something else, and I'll see like my Amazon Prime video account is now just everything my dad has watched.
Yeah, I've noticed that one.
Yeah.
So let's learn a little bit about what this terrorist, John McDougall, was like.
Oh, good.
So John R. McDougall was born in Elmhurst, Illinois, the youngest of five children and son of a building contractor and a homemaker. His family soon moved to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. As a kid, he loved tinkering with cars and CB radios and went on to study management and electrical engineering at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts.
Oh, hey.
After 2 years, he determined that was not for him and moved back to Florida. Do not blame you.
You're wishing you had realized that, right?
I wish I didn't go to college. So he ended up opening his own store in Florida that was a satellite dealership called McDougall Electronics.
Very nice.
Yeah. The company initially turned a healthy profit, but like all other satellite-based industries, following the scrambling of HBO's signal, he lost almost all of his business.
Woof.
Seeing the riots and deciding not to close down completely, McDougall pulled all of the company advertising and saved money by turning off all of his air conditioning. He then took a part-time job at the Central Florida Teleport Uplink Station as an operations engineer to help pay the bills. McDougall was struggling to keep his passion alive and was quoted as saying that he felt like he was watching the great American dream slip from his grasp.
Aww.
He wrote protest letters to legislators and spent a large amount of money to raise awareness about wanting to keep the market free from excessive charging of its services. And one night, McDougall was bored at work after midnight and decided to test his ability with the satellites by transmitting the color bar test pattern, like what they used to use on the TV interrupt for like amber alerts and stuff like that back
when
we were young.
Yeah.
So he just decided to transmute that, or transmit, not transmute. We're not alchemists here.
We could be. We could be. I mean, you're transmuting radio waves.
It's okay. Abandon your thoughts.
I was trying to cover for you.
No. I didn't deserve it. So likely very few people have been watching at this time because HBO never investigated this disturbance.
Oh.
Yep. On April 26th of 1986, McDougall worked at his shop as normal, closed his shop down at a normal time, and after eating dinner, he reported to his job at the Central Florida Teleport with one other engineer in the building. The second engineer had left for the night, and that left McDougall to operate the building on his own.
Ooh.
Before logging off at around midnight, McDougall set up the color bars again and used a Quanta Corporation Microgen MG100 character generator to place the letters that we read on the television screen.
Ah.
He spent a couple of minutes composing his message, and the one that I read earlier, and McDougall said that he began his message with a polite greeting as he didn't really want to be insulting. He selected the name Captain Midnight from a film that he had recently seen, which was called On the Air Live with Captain Midnight.
Oh, okay.
Apparently, there was like some controversy as to whether he had named it after that movie or there also used to be a Captain Midnight radio show.
Oh, okay.
But he eventually clarified that it was the On the Air Live with Captain Midnight movie.
Fair enough.
In an interview with Network World in 2011, McDougall said that he didn't regret his actions, but wished that his motivations were a little more clearly understood. He was quoted as saying, "I do not regret trying to get the message out to corporate America about this unfair pricing and restrictive trade practices. That was the impetus for doing what I did. That's the reason why I jammed HBO. That's the reason I sent them a polite message. What I do regret is that I was young and fairly naive in the ways of media. I didn't grasp the fact that no one would understand my motives and that everyone would make assumptions. Had I known that up front, I would have been much more fervent in explaining my motivations. I had no animus and no malice in my heart." So in a magazine called Mother Jones, ended up determining that the reason why this got taken so seriously was that McDougall could have potentially taken over the signals of three additional satellites, one of which was a CBS satellite, another one was an AT&T satellite, and the last one was one that was above the Galapagos Islands and was a frequency used by the United States Navy for Fleet SATCOM 1.
Okay, here's the trouble. I see.
Yep.
I see what's happening. I was sitting here thinking, as soon as you said he could have taken over other things, I'm like, one of them had to have been like military.
Yep. So his particular dish had, or the company's particular dish that he worked for, had the ability and like the line of sight in the sky to have reached a Navy satellite.
Ah, so
he could have, like, his target, but he could have if he wanted to.
So like it could have like bounced off of there to the other, and then like,
well, he would have had to intentionally have pointed
right,
it there.
Right. Yeah.
But they figured this person has access to these satellites, it could go bad.
Yeah. Yes. All right. I see where the concern came from.
Yeah. So they also posited that an amateur hobbyist could hijack the satellites. And this was one of the ones that American military forces used to monitor Soviet actions. So doing so would have created confusion for world leaders and put the world at risk for nuclear destruction.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So this was an important satellite.
All right, yeah, so like that satellite acting weird could have had much bigger consequences that there's no way that that dude could have possibly known, probably.
Yes.
But if he had had malicious intentions or did know that, he could have, like, there could have been malicious intentions behind it.
Right. And this was one of, like, the first jammings that ever really occurred.
Mm.
So it was kind of put a lot of, like, legislators in their place. And they were like, God, what do we do about this?
Oh, no.
Hence why the FBI and the Department of Justice was so keen to get involved.
Yeah. All right. All right. I'm catching up now. I can see why. It's much bigger than just that one message.
Yeah, I did arrange the way I was going to go through this story to kind of flow like that. So.
Now I feel mean for thinking that they were overreacting.
Yeah. But you still also feel a little bit bad for John McDougal because...
Yeah, like, it wasn't what he did.
Right. So anyways, nothing ended up breaking out as a result of interrupted satellite signals of a Navy fleet SATCOM. The FCC would then go on to place stronger safeguards, including station identification, to better track communications. McDougal, meanwhile, was able to fend off the giant dish downturn and get his footing with the advent of the mini dish industry. So, like, all the little tiny satellite dishes that used to have, like, you know, like, what were they called?
I don't remember.
Well, I feel like Dish Network was one of them.
Right, yeah, like, they were just, like,
Discovery a dish thing, too, as well?
The only other thing I can think of is, like, DirecTV.
DirecTV, yep.
Because that's what we had for, like, a hot second when I was a kid.
Yeah. So, basically, he moved from large at-home satellite dishes to the small network broadcasting ones that were kind of approved.
Okay, new question. How big were these at-home satellites?
Big. Like, I saw when I was reading about this that some of the most advanced people looked like they're... There were reporters or just people who observed that said that these looked like mini NASA stations.
Okay, because I was literally envisioning like the DirecTV dishes from the get-go.
No, that comes much later.
Okay, yeah. Alrighty then.
And, like, the satellite that he worked at, the one that they had at his work, was a 30-foot diameter satellite.
Okay.
It was big.
I feel like my disconnect was coming from not recognizing that, A, the little ones didn't really exist yet.
Yep.
And, like, computing, like, it was literally, like, television broadcasting equipment, but at home.
Right.
It wasn't, like, a home version. It was, like, that stuff, but you had it for yourself.
Right, which is why I mentioned at the beginning that it was like plans were passed out from engineers and stuff like that to made simpler so that the public could do it.
All right, I'm a dummy because I was envisioning like the little ones the whole time.
Yeah, and like the one that he used, like for reference, like to you, Kylie, like 30-foot diameter is bigger than our house's square. Like, it's about a circle the size of the entire inside of our house.
Where did people have space to put those?
It's a company.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, right. But, like, I'm envisioning someone putting that in their backyard because
I mean, I don't think anyone had them that big in their backyard. Probably some people did, but.
Okay, so, like, somewhere in between, like, industrial size and, like, mini tiny ones that we mounted on our houses.
Yeah, they probably had, like, 5 to 10 foot diameter satellites and stuff like that, whereas, like, the DirecTV ones are, like, 2 foot diameter.
Right, yeah. Okay, so, like, a nice, like, in between size of, like, not...
I mean, they were probably the size of the chair you're sitting in.
There we go.
We have one of those rounded like basket chair things. I forget what they're called. They have a specific name.
It has a name. It starts with a P. It's like a pat I want to say like Pashimon, but I know I'm only saying that because I'm like getting confused with like Digimon.
Oh boy. Anyways, so HBO never ended up getting targeted since this time again. And it wasn't the end of hijacked transmissions, though. In November of 1987, a Chicago station had their local news interrupted by a man in a Max Headroom mask dancing in front of the camera. Later that night, the same individual, supposedly, took over a PBS affiliate and mooned the audience.
I think I remember hearing about that one.
So really strange. I didn't end up looking more into this, but I should have. But for some reason, I saw a lot of Max Headroom videos like popping up again recently. Like, not researching this, I ran into someone posting the Max Headroom video from when he hijacked that station.
Huh.
So I don't know what context in current pop culture that the Weird. Max Headroom video just came back, but I remember seeing that completely unrelated to my research recently.
Odd. Yeah. That is very odd.
So yeah, that guy was never found, ever.
Oh,
yep,
well.
That one escaped.
Good job, dude. You kept your anonymity.
Yes. Well, anyways, that's the story of Captain Midnight.
Alrighty.
So, call to action.
Woohoo!
You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Halfwit History. You can find our website at www.halfwit-history.com. And you can shoot us an email at halfwitpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, give us feedback, suggestions, nice critique, or even like topic ideas would be awesome since we're quickly approaching our 1 year.
Yeah, that's coming up.
Yeah, it might be fun to like, you know, get to do like a fan pick or something like that for something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can also support us if you don't want to send us suggestions. You can support us with monies by going to ko-fi.com/halfwithistory. It's like a little tip jar website. It's kind of neat.
Yeah.
So it's not like Patreon where you have to like subscribe. It's just, here's a few bucks.
Yeah. It's like a nice like one-off donation. Like instead of having to subscribe to do it monthly.
Yeah.
It's like a nice, you know, like, oh, like, I really enjoy your thing, but I don't want to pay, like, $5 a month, so here's, like, a $5 one-off donation kind
yeah,
of thing.
Yeah, and we had a few, I think we had a few donations to it already, so thank
yeah.
you to whoever did that. They
yeah.
were definitely anonymous, so.
Yeah. We appreciate it, and we'd like to know who you are.
Yeah. And thank you to The Fisherman for the use of our theme song, Another Day. You can find their link down in our show notes. They have a SoundCloud. Go check them out. They have a lot of cool songs.
Yeah, it's pretty fun. There's a lot of nice stuff out there.
You're Speaking of there. Fun, on to fun facts?
Fun facts.
Cool. You want to go first since you didn't get to talk at all this episode?
So, on April 27th, 1932, Casey Kasem was born.
Casey Kasem?
Yeah. For anyone who's not for anyone who's not familiar, he was the voice of Shaggy
yeah.
on Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, I know that is Shaggy. I
okay.
just can't do a Shaggy voice on command.
Gotcha. I follow.
Ruh-roh, Raggy.
But what I didn't know was that he was also the creator of the music radio program American Top 40.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably because, you know, I listened to that in the late 90s and early 2000s, I probably didn't notice that.
Yeah.
Surprise!
If anyone heard that, that's our rabbit being angry at us and thumping.
She wants attention.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, my fun fact is on April 28th of 1902, using the ISO 8601 standard year zero definition for the Gregorian calendar, which was preceded by the Julian calendar, the 1 billionth minute since the start of January 1st, year zero, occurs at 10:40 a.m.
Ooh.
So
that's nifty.
Yeah, it's kind of neat. Also really puts into perspective what a billion is.
Yeah.
From year zero
yeah.
to 10:40 a.m. on April 28th, 1902
yeah.
is 1 billion minutes. Think
yeah.
about that in terms of money for a second.
Oh, God, I'm so
that
poor.
That makes money so much astronomically bigger. I think that when I read that, it really put into perspective exactly how much a billion is.
Yeah. In minutes, It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of minutes.
Yeah, lots of minutes. Yeah. Anywho, that's been our show. As always, I've been your halfwit.
And I'm your historian.
And we hope to see you next week.
Bye. Since you've gone.